This is Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson. Sponsored by Know Better, Do Better, KBDB. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Dr. Phil Knight.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for listening. At Food Secure Nation, we believe the mission of building food security moves at the speed of trust. We first encountered that idea through Stephen R. Covey. That trust isn't soft. It is measurable, an accelerative force. But it was John Maxwell who sharpened it for us when he said, "Nothing of significance happens except through relationship." When you put those two ideas together, something powerful emerges. Trust is the fruit of real relationship. And without trust, partnership stalls, collaborations fracture, and systems stagnate. Food security is not achieved by intention alone. It requires coordinated effort. Nonprofits, government, philanthropy, business, and communities moving in alignment toward the next threshold of food security. But alignment only happens when trust is strong. And trust is built when words match work. Right now, across the nonprofit sector, that trust is being tested. Expectations are rising, technology is accelerating, data is multiplying, and the public is asking harder questions about impact, accountability, and credibility. So the issue isn't whether we care. The issue is whether we are building the kind of trust that allows partnership to move at the speed this moment demands. And that's exactly why today's conversation matters. Our guest, Tori Martin, works at the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy, where she helps study and interpret national trends shaping the nonprofit and philanthropic world. Her work looks beyond headlines to examine how trust, technology, and data are reshaping how nonprofits operate and how the public experiences their work. Because strengthening food security and strengthening the nonprofit sector requires good information, good judgment, and the courage to adapt. Tori Martin, a nationally recognized researcher, joins us next, and we're glad you're with us. Welcome back, everyone. Jerry, great to see you across the microphone here, as always, my friend.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I can't wait. I know I say this, but it's really true. I'm an eager person. I can't wait to hear from Tori Martin today. She is an incredibly smart and energetic person, and I'm just so eager to just get this conversation going.
Well, Tori Martin is our guest today, and she is the Director of Engagement and Knowledge Building at the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy. Well, aren't you impressed I said that well?
I am, really.
So
I put a little gold star on the calendar.
Yeah, you know, I'm from L.A. originally, which means Lower Alabama, so we struggle with the English is not our first language. So with that esteemed introduction, Tori, welcome to Food Secure Nation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that lovely welcome.
It's great to have you. And before we jump into this tremendous report that you've authored and you and your team talking about trends and particularly faced by the nonprofit world, let's start with you. So you serve as the Director of Engagement and Knowledge Building, and this report talks about lots of national trends. But I'll tell you, our listeners, they want to know about you. So introduce yourself to us and to our listeners.
Sure, happy to do so. Well, I have been with the Johnson Center for 8 years now, and I've had the pleasure and the challenge of producing this 11 Trends in Philanthropy report every year that I've been here. This is our 10th year of doing it. And, you know, writing is my job. Writing has always been what I do. You know, I joked to my friends when I was graduating college that my only skill set was writing, and thank God I found a job doing that. So it was a little bit of a circuitous route. I actually started, so I'm from the DC area originally, and I started at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, where I did audience engagement and educational programs for about 4 years. And then, as is probably fairly typical in the nonprofit world, I went into fundraising. I did that with National Public Radio for just under 2 years. I worked on their foundations and institutional giving team. And that's about when my husband and I decided we wanted to leave the D.C. area and go see something else in the world, find another way of living. So we moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan. My commute went from 1.25 hours to 8 minutes. Wow. And we've been here ever since. Been with the Johnson Center since we made that move.
I have to just talk about fundraising for a minute. I've been in fundraising for 40 years, and I like it. I'm one of the few. but I will say this. When I used to present to boards about fundraising, I used to say, would you rather ask someone for money or have pox all over your body?
Oh, my God.
And the first thing people would say to me is, well, do they hurt or do they just itch?
Oh, my gosh.
Are we talking chicken pox? Yeah.
I mean, that's how much people don't like fundraising. But good for you to have done it for a couple of years, because it certainly seasons how you understand the writing of the work. Right. And now that you're in philanthropy, having been on that side of the fence really gives you some deep insight into, you know, the kinds of things you have to be able to say and do if you want to be successful. So how terrific is that?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, when I was first hired at the Johnson Center, and my role has expanded in a number of ways, but it was really development and communications, because they are, in a lot of ways, the same kind of role. I mean, I think development, being in fundraising, really teaches you about crafting resonant stories and reading the room about the kind of story that someone needs to hear but wants to hear. Also, you need to be able to kind of scale your story to what people are going to be able to absorb, resonate with, respond to. They're really similar roles. It's just, you know, in development, you might be talking to one person at a time, and in communications, you're often talking to, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands, or millions.
Yeah.
Dr. Phil, really related.
Yeah. Dr. Phil likes to call that putting the cookies on the right shelf.
Yeah.
I think that's that in a food related podcast, that feels very on brand.
Well, that way everybody can have some.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, Tori, let's thank you for introducing yourself and whatever that pox analogy was there. I'm not sure, but that's
we'll put
okay.
Put away any imagery related to that conversation. Yeah.
So I can't wait to dive into the report that you've written, and particularly one of the trends you and your team identified is titled "Beyond Good Intentions: Nonprofits Must Show Good Work to Build Trust." That is a powerful statement.
You know, it comes from so for this year's report, we really took a longer view. As I mentioned, this is our 10th annual report, so we've been doing it for a decade. The report is composed of 11 different articles looking at individual topics across the field. For this year's report, we looked at all 99 previous trends, individual articles that we had written, and kind of looked for themes, both as a reflective approach, you know, on this anniversary, but also just in recognition of the state of the world. It feels incredibly difficult to predict what might be around the corner right now. And one of the, you know, main themes that really stood out to us was around trust. There have been a lot of ups and downs in our writing about this subject over the last decade. We've always kind of come back to the Edelman Trust Barometer, which is a global survey that asks about the public's trust in each of the four sectors, nonprofit, NGOs, business, government, and media, to act ethically and to act competently. And nonprofits have always been in a pretty strong position when it came to ethical behavior. They're at the top of that particular pyramid. But they're not seen as competent on a global scale. You can dig into that data and look specifically at what's going on in the U.S., but the only sector globally that is seen as both ethical and competent is business. And this competence question is something that we have always wrestled with in the field because it's incredibly difficult to show what you're doing and what your impact is. If you are working on a public health initiative, you know, you can track how many fewer smokers there are in your community, for instance, but you can't necessarily quantify all the savings of people who don't have lung cancer and don't have, you know, children living in secondhand smoke environments and, you know, the million other follow-on effects. So it's really hard to tell a succinct story of competence in the way that the business sector, for instance, is able to do by saying, you know, Amazon posted such and such profits.
You know, I so resonate with everything you're saying. And as a nonprofit leader for a long time and the CEO of a large food bank, the difficulty with competence is nobody pays you for it.
Yeah,
I mean, seriously, you're paid for services, right? And in fact, you're measured by how little you can spend to become competent. I mean, you know, if you have any administrative dollars that looks like it's going to you, people go, what am I paying you for? Shouldn't you be feeding people? And so, you know, and then there's whole comparisons made and you know, charts built around how much do you generate in services for every dollar that you spend, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you look at what nonprofit people get rewarded for, becoming competent isn't on the list. Even though people want it and they say they want it, and in some ways they demand it, especially in the board meetings, right? But at the end of the day, when the annual report comes out, there's no measure for competence that people go, we'd like to see that move from an 8 to a 10.
Right. And they don't. And if you are, you know, demonstrating incredible competence, running tight ship organizations that are able to expand or really provide services at the scale that are needed, it's not like anyone wants to see your salary go up.
Right. Right.
There's from a professionalization standpoint, it's not people. The general public does not see that carrot as making sense within our field.
As we look at, you know, the pivoting you have to do on a day-to-day basis. You get so busy putting one foot in front of the other just because the things around you are changing, and it's something that you weren't planning on when you started the year, and now you have something like a pandemic, or you have something like the loss of half your funding because the pandemic is over, right? And so that's what you're working on. It makes you competent in some ways, but I know we got to take a break, and Phil's going to smack me here.
I'm waving at him right now.
You know. That 5-minute
line. Right. Yeah, so, you know, so I guess next week we're going to have Dan Pallotta, who wrote Uncharitable, on the on the show.
I've heard him speak; he's lovely.
I really do. I love the concept, but it ties right into what we're talking about here and competence. Let's take a quick break, guys. We're going to come back. We have Tori Martin with us from the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy and Jerry Brisson. I'm Dr. Phil Knight. We're all three back with you in just a moment.
You're listening to Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson. Sponsored by Know Better, Do Better.
Welcome back. Thanks for listening, everyone. Tori Martin, our guest today. That's Jerry Brisson. I'm Dr. Phil Knight. Don't waste any more time. Jump to your question, Jerry.
Yeah, just really, how does a nonprofit demonstrate better competence? Is there an example or something that came out of the research or your thoughts even that would point to that?
Well, you know, I think we didn't focus explicitly on examples this year, but we did look at sort of levers for building that story of competence and trust. Mm. One is really around language. There's a lot of work in commentary and growing professional development opportunities right now about how nonprofits can get back to talking like normal people. you know, we have a lot of jargon. It's, you know, we're not unique in that. Every industry has its own jargon. But the recommendations, if you're in a, you know, if you're in a communications course or something, is really to write to about a sixth grade level. And you can adjust that obviously based on your expected audience and, you know, who you're talking to in the, scenario that you're in when you're doing the talking. But you really want to be focused on language that everyone can understand. And so that, I think, is an important part of being able to show and communicate what you're doing. And then the second is really around proximity. We see a lot across trust data that proximity is a almost a proxy for trust. It's people trust the organizations that are close to them, that they see active in the community, that they can themselves, you know, go to a meeting, go to an event, connect with the person in charge, connect with the people who are running the programs. So if you can be present and find a way to say and share things that you are doing locally and point to that park that you go to on the weekends, do you see how all the playground equipment got replaced? That was us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the ways you can really, I mean, it obviously is a specific example for organizations that are hyper-local or place-based, as opposed to the mid to national-sized organizations that will have different kinds of challenges. But making it physical and making it accessible as a story, I think is really important.
Tori, I'm having the picture in my mind of a playground with a seesaw on it. And so On one end of the seesaw is trust, and on the other end of the seesaw is expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So is trust declining and expectations rising, or is the seesaw level?
Wow, what an analogy. I almost feel like both ends of the seesaw are going down. you know, like trust is declining because people don't think their expectations are going to be met. You know, their expectations have been flouted too many times. It's been a challenging century in terms of trust and believing in institutions and groups around you.
Well, I've never had fun on a seesaw where both sides were going down at the same time.
I know. It's pretty bleak. It's hard not to sound bleak. But I do think people are hungry for opportunities to connect right now. You know, even within our own organization, when we talk about, well, what can we do? It's invite your neighbors over for dinner. You know, go be in your public spaces. Sit on your porch. Talk to the people who walk by. Those are things that build trust, build feelings of community and inclusion. And the more that you can do that as an organization or figure out what that looks like as an organization, you know, invite somebody else who does your similar work over for donuts. That all of that can be felt as impact.
So, I could camp here all day and we do multiple shows just on the idea of trust and competence. And I thank you for bringing this to light. And also our language, how we talk about the work is vitally important. But, you know, people who do this work care about the work. They care about the people. But one of the very clear evidences of your report is people just want to know if the work they're investing in, whether it's their life or their time or their talent, is making a difference. And I can't disagree with any of that. So we have to collectively, as a nonprofit world, do better. And of course, doing better is is what we're about around here. Is know better so we can do better. Thank you, Maya Angelou. And that brings us to another major force shaping trend that you guys highlighted, which is artificial intelligence.
And
for some of the people that I hang around, it's the only kind they have. So talk to us a little bit about, as we start, you know, the last half of this segment, about weighing the power of AI against its impact.
Yeah, you know, AI is, it's a situation where it's here, right? We cannot avoid it. And if you don't learn how to use it, you're going to be an enormous disadvantage in the marketplace, no matter what your role is. And at the same time, it has significant risks, you know, all from chatbots that give terrible suggestions to the people who are seeking help via them, all the way to, you know, our Terminator apocalypse somewhere in the future. But it is such a powerful tool, and the technology will improve. You know, I read somewhere the notion that you are today using the worst AI you will ever use.
Yeah.
It's only going to get better from here. It's only going to get, you know, hopefully less harmful to the environment. It's only going to get more targeted and more able to answer your questions, do your tasks. But I worry, too, about, you know, early indications that AI is really removing entry-level positions from the market. You know, those first coding positions, the first communications positions, the first administrative support positions. And that is how people get into the middle class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see which way that actually goes, if AI creates jobs or gets rid of jobs. I mean, 1956 or 57, I should know this right off the top of my head, was the first year that tractors outnumbered horses and mules on farms in the U.S., right?
That's a fascinating date.
Prior to that, there was a huge industry around tack and the tools you needed to work with horses and mules on a farm, right? The plows, the technology that was in place, and that really made a lot of people very busy, right? A lot of people were doing that work. And I know that's a really simplistic example, but nonetheless, every significant advance in technology, there has been an impact. And that impact is real for people that grew up learning how to work with horses, and then that was not needed anymore. And so for a generation, there were kids that expected to do one thing that couldn't do that anymore. And it has always been somewhat negative along with somewhat positive. Right. Both of those things have gone together with technology for a long time. So AI is a big deal for us. We're training our AI right now. We've been training it for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because until you start delving deeper into what AI actually knows, you make a lot of assumptions about what it knows, and I'm guessing that has to be part of the weighing the power of AI against its impact, because you can really get some screwed up information.
Oh, yeah, and we're a data shop at the Johnson Center, and the biases inherent in so many of our existing data sets and the ways that we collect data as a society are real risks. And it's interesting. Candid, which is a major infrastructure group in the field that formed out of a merger between Foundation Center and Grantcraft a number of years ago, they actually just laid off 42 people, about a fifth of their staff, in order to pivot to creating good data sets to feed AI, specifically because they are recognizing that, you know, the federal government is retreating from data. And even when they, even before these shifts, you know, the IRS puts out employment data on the nonprofit sector once every 5 years. That is not sufficient for us to be able to understand how to develop and support our field. So Candid is making a shift towards creating better data, trying to collect data directly from grant makers and nonprofits instead of going via the IRS 990 forms, to support improved AI to benefit the sector.
Wow. We've got to unpack a little bit more on this, so we're going to leak this over into the next segment, if that's okay. She's Tori Martin. She's with the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy. She is the Director of Engagement and Knowledge Building. That's Jerry Brisson. I'm Dr. Phil Knight. Come back and be with us. Thanks for listening, everyone. Jerry Brisson, Dr. Phil Knight here, and our very special guest, Tori Martin from the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy. It was a great philosopher, Tori. I think his name was Jerry Seinfeld, who said, you know, we're smart enough to need AI. We're smart enough to invent it. We're dumb enough to need it, but we're not ethical enough to know if we did the right thing or not.
Wow, doesn't that sum it up?
Yeah,
like pretty much everything.
Yeah, pretty much. So
democracy, I don't know.
But one of the points you make in the report, and the one you shared here in the last segment, was it's happening. This train is moving. It has left the station. And you're going to be at a disadvantage if you don't have found a way to incorporate it into your work at some level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Jerry, we're incorporating it into our work.
Yeah, we think it's critical. And in fact, it leads right into the next point, the next one of the 11, which is the need for both data and context. And the way that we're trying to use AI is really around context and making sure that the people who are doing the work and the people who are using the services of the nonprofit world have a way to talk about their beliefs and their thoughts that are beyond what research can demonstrate. And so that data and context, we find it is critically important right now to be finding a way to bring context to data. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about that as you wrote that part of the report.
I think we talk, where my mind goes is to participatory research, participatory data. I think there's been wonderful movements in the field towards ensuring that whenever you collect data, you do the meaning making out of that data with the people who provided it in the first place. You're not just looking for the words that pop out to you, but the words that pop out to them. You know, what was their emphasis? And I think it'll be really interesting to see how can we translate that through technology, or can we? I mean, is it even still, like, I'd be curious to hear more about how you're capturing those experiences with AI and then what it's spitting back out, right, as opposed to bringing people into a room to talk and kind of where you would go from there.
Yeah, so without getting into all the challenges of when you bring people in a room to talk and who talks and who doesn't talk and people feeling like they won't listen until they've said what they have to say. And so you have a room full of people not listening to anyone until everyone has talked, and now you're out of time. So I mean, you know.
Other than that, it's a really great idea.
And even with focus groups and things like that, we know the challenges with trying to, get data out. What we think AI can help with is iterating. So you do things virtually, so people don't all have to be there at the same time. They can get to it when they have time to get to it and can focus on it. You still have to have some time limits so that you can move the conversation ahead. But what we think AI can do is take an enormous amount of input, as much input as people want to give, and then give it back to the group and say, here's the main themes that came out of this conversation. Here's the things that seem to rise to the top. Does that resonate with the group? And you iterate and iterate and iterate so that you get people more and more focused on the things that generally the group finds important and significant as they're trying to problem solve. That's what our idea is anyway about one of the ways AI can be helpful. And then that becomes fodder for other people seeking information about whatever it is you're talking about. So that you're feeding AI from people who are doing the work, the things that are rising to the top in the field. I mean, and that's really simplistic, but I think, as I looked at...
You got the cookies on the right shelf for me there.
Yeah.
But as I looked at the three things we're talking with you about, we need to have trust, we need to consider where AI can have the most impact, and then we need to use that to build new ways of bringing context to data. I think those three are so interconnected. So anyway, your thoughts on that process is fine, but also glad to hear other things that you have learned as a result of diving into those topics.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what you said is that it's still a very high human touch experience, right? Like, you are using AI as a tool, but the project and the meaning making is still being led by humans. And that is kind of the key. I think there's a danger right now between letting AI lead and letting humans lead. And that's sort of the narrow lane we're all trying to walk, to remember that you can't actually let AI replace the people on your team, the skill sets on your team. You do still have to have that. And I think the more you can show that, tell the story of how you're building that AI, goes back to the questions of both competence and trust. You know, if you can, honestly, like, it's a really interesting competence story of being able to say to the public, here's an AI tool that we figured out how to use and what to do with. And I think since people are still so, you know, kind of in awe of AI and don't know what to do with it themselves, showing a innovative use for it, that's a competence story. Mm-hmm. And that gives people an understanding of, like, oh, okay, you used this for good. You still made sure that that people were included in the process. That builds competence and trust and relationship.
What I hear you saying is that it's not either or, it's both and it's the right tool used by the right professional at the right time for the right purpose. And the antithesis illustration of that is, I had a flat tire, had to get off the highway, and the only tool I had to fix the flat tire and change it was a hammer.
Yeah.
And it didn't work very well.
You can lop off the lug nuts, but
right.
That's as far as you're going to get.
Yeah, it just didn't work, you know? So you need to do the job, you need the right person, the right professional, using the right tool to get the right outcome. And AI is a tool that's led by humans. It's not a apocalypse scenario, at least not yet, but it's that's what I'm hearing you say. And I think what we're doing at Know Better, Do Better and Food Secure Nation, it is we could not do what we want to do for the sector without it.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it speaks to another theme in our report, which is trying to bring in some silver lining pieces here, which is, like, the era of innovation that we are in and that we are going to be in is enormous. I mean, with all of the changes that we've seen, all of the unfortunately, the loss of funding, the shifting of priorities, the loss of data sets, the loss of kind of, you know, infrastructure type response organizations like FEMA. Without those, none of the need for that went away. Hmm. And so, you know, hopefully what this means is that necessity will be the mother of invention, and we're going to make some big leaps in interesting ways to address these challenges in new ways and without the government and potentially in a much more locally community ground up way. I think there's, you know, one of the pieces that we talk about is really the expectation around seeing increased partnerships between philanthropy, nonprofits, and business, because a lot of the things that we're talking about here, they don't have clean market solutions. There's not a clean market solution to disaster response, but it's going to need to happen. Someone's going to have to figure it out.
Well, and I'm just going to make one more comment, and I know we're going to run out of time, but I just want to comment back to compassion, because the reason why a lot of us get into helping work, wherever we fall in that spectrum, is because we care about other people. And I think if we think about AI as a way to demonstrate compassion, understanding how can we really help the people who are doing their very best to make a difference. If we can keep that our focus, I think we will find our way to the innovations that not only create more impact, but really demonstrate compassion on the ground for people who have a lot to figure out.
Philanthropy, love of humanity.
Yeah, 100%. She is the Director of Engagement and Knowledge Building at the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy, and she, Tori Martin, has been our guest today on Food Secure Nation. Tori, thank you, not only for being our guest, but for how you're investing your one handful of life through this this Center for Philanthropy. It means a lot to us, and we appreciate you.
Well, thank you all so much for inviting me on to have this conversation. It's a true delight and honor to be here, so thank you very much.
Jerry and I are back in just a moment to wrap up this edition of Food Secure Nation.
Food Secure Nation is sponsored by Know Better, Do Better. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Once again, here are Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson.
Welcome back, Jerry. I really like Tori Martin.
I do too, and I got to give a shout out to my wife who introduced me to Tori by sending me the report, The 11 Trends in Philanthropy for 2026, and Katie's the best, and it's just another example of what a lucky man I am.
You outpunted your coverage for sure. Time for a little food for thought. A mentor of mine once told me nothing of significant changes except through relationship. I believe that. And relationships aren't microwaved. They're built slowly through honesty, consistency, and trust, which is why this next thought matters. In the nonprofit sector, we sometimes undermine our own credibility by overstating our role. We say, we'll end hunger, or we'll shorten the line. But hunger is shaped by wages, housing, healthcare, education, public policy, and lots more. And no one nonprofit can solve those things alone. When our language implies otherwise, even with good intentions, we blur the line between aspiration and reality. And when reality doesn't match the promise, trust erodes quietly. Not because people are cynical, but because they're paying attention. Strong missions don't need exaggeration. They need clarity. The truth is, food banks are a critical response system. They reduce hardship. They meet urgent need. They create stability for families in tough seasons. This is meaningful and measurable work. But ending hunger requires coordinated systems beyond charity alone. Saying that out loud does not weaken our case. It strengthens our integrity. Because credibility is built when our claims match our capacity. And trust is sustained when our words match our work. A mission that's honest will outlast a message that's exaggerated. And that's how we build a food secure nation.